Hey everybody, just a quick programming note before this episode starts. When I originally set out to do Hugo's There 2.0, I mentioned that I was going to do a four-episode cycle, where I was going to do two more or less regular episodes, one with a book that I wanted to do, and one with a guest pick. And then I would also do two zoomed-out episodes, an author kind of deep dive, and a subgenre spotlight. And my idea was to alternate those, and so I'd do a regular episode, a zoom-out, a regular episode, a zoom-out. And that was my plan, but it turns out that the schedule got a little tight toward the end of this year. And one thing that I do like to provide for my patrons is early access to episodes. And so I wasn't going to be able to do that unless I made some kind of a change. And so it happens that I have my next two zoomed out episodes recorded already. And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to make a sandwich. So there's going to be bookends of two zoomed out episodes. The first one is going to be an author focused episode, and the last one will be a subgenre episode. And in between there, I'll have two back-to-back regular episodes, one of them where my guest picked the topic and one where my guest volunteered to do one that I picked. And then hopefully in the future, I will get back to doing just the normal kind of alternating pattern. So sorry if you were expecting a regular episode. I do think that you're going to enjoy what I have here, though. So I will now turn it over to me in the past recording the Zoom Out episode. Hi there, everybody, and welcome back to Hugo's There 2.0, and we are doing another author deep dive, a zoomed out episode, and this time we are going to be talking about Patricia MacKillop, and my guest for this episode is Audrey Taylor. Hi there, Audrey.
Hi, Seth. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for reaching out. I understand you're friends with a previous guest on this podcast.
I am. I'm friends with Paul Williams, and he had mentioned your podcast, and it sounded interesting, so thanks for having me.
Yeah, and thank you so much for reaching out. On this topic, because I was looking, you know, I had a number of authors who I'm like, well, I definitely want to do Bradbury and Asimov and Clark and things like that. And yours came in and I went, I've never heard that name before. And so that's fantastic. And then I sent it out to my patrons on Patreon and said, hey, which one of these, you know, because I have guests sort of tentatively booked for several of those authors. And Patricia MacKillop ended up winning. So here we are.
Awesome.
So why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself? What should people know about you?
Okay. So like my official long name is Dr. Audrey Isabel Taylor. And I am an assistant professor of English at Colorado State University Pueblo, where I get to teach writing and literature and sneak in fantasy and science fiction and stuff. They're very welcoming of that though. So that's nice. So that's like my official thing. I did write a book on Patricia MacKillop called Patricia A. MacKillop and the Art of Fantasy World Building.
Yes.
And I also did my PhD on her.
Yeah. And it's an interesting book. I actually picked up a copy from my library, and I, you know, it's kind of an academic book, right?
It's very much that
because you go through kind of world building in general, what it means, and then what it looks like in science fiction and hard science fiction and fantasy and all these other genres, and which was really fascinating. I didn't get to read the entire thing. It was maybe a little over my head. but it was quite accessible, actually.
Well, thank you for picking it up.
Yeah.
It was intended to be fairly, like, it is an academic book, and it was for an academic press and, you know, peer reviewed and all that. But it is intended to be as accessible as possible within that.
So,
I'm glad you picked it up. I think I've had some reviews that said from like librarians and things who found it interesting. And so that's always fun.
Yeah. And, you know, I've said for a while, kind of since I started getting back into science fiction, that one of the things that I don't really love in fantasy is world building. And I think what I don't like is world building that you can really see, right? That you're like, we are building a world in capital letters, right? And when it's done through character viewpoints and I don't know, when it's done artfully, I don't notice it. It doesn't bother me.
Right. I mean, I think what you don't like is probably bad world building. And I think Patricia MacKillop is a great example of where it's done often very subtly. Mm-hmm. And it's one of the things that I'm kind of academically as well as personally interested in is how authors do it well. You know, and how do you not see it in ways that it's kind of not banging you over the head?
Yeah. I mean, and, you know, it's not like science fiction is immune to that kind of thing.
Definitely not.
And it's sometimes not so much world building as just, hey, let me show you that I did the homework. and I'm going to show you my hard science fiction. Everything is right. It checks out. You know, test me on this and see that I'm correct.
Right, which is one of the things that actually I was kind of averse to science fiction for a long time because I felt like I needed a degree in science, and my degree is definitely not in science. And then I realized, but actually, if you just take the what the author's saying as a given and move forward, then you can just enjoy the rest of the story without worrying about it.
Yes, sometimes they won't let you just turn the page and move on. Right? It's the rest of this chapter. All right.
Yeah. Which is probably not the kind that I would be reading, to be fair.
Yeah. I didn't warn you about this kind of topic, but did you want to talk about anything from your book, on the art of fantasy world building, like the differences between science fiction and fantasy world building?
So one of the key differences in the book between kind of how world building is talked about in the world and then how I was particularly using it is that world building, as my colleague Stefan Ekman from Karlstad University in Sweden and I had realized, is that everybody uses world building in a different way, which means it's not very useful to talk about in an academic sense, because when you have something that has so many different definitions and so many different people's ideas of what it means, then you can't really pin things down with it.
Sure.
And so one of the things that we kind of discovered or have been thinking through is that world building is actually like there's lots of different types of world building depending on who's doing it.
Right.
So you have the readerly world building, which is probably what you were doing and what I do when I'm just reading something for fun. And then there's critical world building, which is what I do when I'm like being my academic self with a capital A and reading texts, looking for particular details and using my, my schooling to kind of really read closely and all that kind of thing. And then there's also authorial world building, which is like how authors themselves are thinking about and setting up their world. And that's what most people talk about when they talk about world building. And then we've also kind of discovered we kind of discovered that we think there's at least another fourth, if not more than that, which is what we called encyclopedic world building, where it's like the kind of Tolkien fan where they have every detail of every single book memorized and every single letter and every subletter and every postscript on every subletter. And they can bring to mind chapter 32 of the Silmarillion, you know, quotes this one period that was also used in book 7 of the edited manuscripts or something.
Right.
And so that kind of, we decided that it was also a different kind of putting the world together than most of us do, even when we're fans.
Yeah.
So that's kind of the basis of the book. And it was almost created for MacKillop because I was doing her and working on her for my PhD and was so immersed in her worlds and her books. And it was just one of the things that caught my attention about her work.
Nice. Well, on that note, why don't we move into sort of some author intro of Patricia MacKillop? Any biographical details you want to go through? Anything like why she's interesting?
So Patricia MacKillop, who has now unfortunately passed away, just passed away last year, actually, was a really, really interesting, largely fantasy author. She did, in fact, write a couple of science fiction books, but they completely bombed, and she never went back to writing science fiction. It was pretty clear that wasn't really her area. She did write a lot of short stories, which is not my primary area, so mostly I did her novels. She was the first winner of the first World Fantasy Award with The Forgotten Beasts of Eld. And then she also won it later in the 90s with Ombria and Shadow. So she was a two-time Fantasy Award winner. She also won a lot of other awards, several times the Mythopoeic Award and lots of other kind of fantasy-related awards like those. So she was really award-winning. She was very well known by other authors when she passed away. Authors like Delia Sherman were very public about how saddened they were at her passing because they would no longer get these wonderful books that only she could really create. And so she was really, in some ways, an author's author, because a lot of the other fantasy or even science fiction authors like Stephen R. Donaldson think that she's just amazing, that her writing was just amazing. But she's also an author that, you know, if you haven't encountered her, you have not encountered her. So I tend to run into kind of two camps of people, people who have never heard of her or people who have read every book she's ever written.
Okay. I'm definitely in the former.
Right. There's very few people who once they've read one or, you know, one or two of them that they don't keep reading more because they find, you know, she's just, she's quite unique. And I think her writing is just really beautiful, along with having kind of interesting takes on stories and all that. So although she's not as kind of popularly recognized as other authors like maybe Le Guin or things like that, she does have her own fan base. She does have people that are super interested in her. And again, people who have read every book that she's ever written and who are sad that there won't be any more now.
Mm. It was funny because when I mentioned to my friend Colin that I see almost every day, he's a much bigger fantasy fan, and he does a science fiction podcast with me, which is funny. And I mentioned, hey, I discovered a new author through, you know, through doing this podcast, Patricia MacKillop. And he went, oh, I've read a ton of MacKillop. And there were things that, that he read as a kid in his public library. And so that was fun. Just somebody I didn't know, but fantasy fans in the know are aware.
Often, yeah. And again, when they aren't, I have a number of kind of colleagues or people that I've met, and I would recommend a book for them because they were working on something to do with some aspect of her work. And, you know, they go on reading 20 of them and they're like, why did you introduce me to her? I have only so much money to spend on books and I want to buy all of them.
I was going to mention this because when I did my episode kind of wrapping up the previous version of the podcast, working through the Hugo winners, I said that, you know, I need some time back to do leisure reading. And so I'm going to do some of these zoomed out episodes where I don't have to do so much reading. And then I read four books for this podcast. but the fact was, it was pleasure reading. And it's not always that way if it's assigned, right? And in this case, there was nothing assigned. I didn't have to read anything. But I read the first one and enjoyed it enough that I thought, okay, I'm going to pick up a few more. So that was fun.
Well, I'm glad you enjoyed them. They should be enjoyed, I think.
Is it fair to, I've seen her writing categorized as YA, but I feel like nobody categorized things as YA until like 1995 or later. That's an arbitrary, I'm just figuring, like, I had never heard of a young adult novel until I was reading to my son.
Yeah, it's definitely a new category or, you know, newish the last 20, 25 years. And there are some of her books that I would categorize as YA, where she has like adolescent protagonists in particular. So maybe The Book of Atrix Wolf or Alphabet of Thorn. Those have like, you know, adolescent protagonists who are going through growing up, changing kind of issues along with this whole fantasy world and like the world is ending and all this dramatic stuff happening. Those I would classify as YA. She also has one that's almost explicitly kind of right on the border of children's and YA. I think it's more a YA than a children's book, but it's often shelved as a children's book, and that's The Changeling Sea.
Okay.
But everything else I think is fairly firmly like, adolescents can read it. Of course, I was reading her as a teenager, regardless of what it was put on the shelves at. But I think most of her, the rest of her stuff would be probably categorized as adult.
Okay.
Fantasy, but not, you know, capital A adult, but just.
Yeah. You know. Right. Exactly. Certainly you're not going to get the same experience reading this as, the Song of Ice and Fire series.
Definitely not.
Yeah.
This is definitely far more PC. I think she has
family friendly. Yeah.
Yeah. I think she has a very beautiful way of talking about relationships, but they are not explicit.
Yes. Yeah. And I do think that, you know, asking that question invites categorizing things and in a way that can be negative, right? Because as soon as you drop the YA category onto a book, there is a subset of people who think, well, adults shouldn't read those books. And I don't know, fantasy and science fiction fandom certainly are not immune to gatekeeping and telling people what you should or should not read.
Yeah, definitely. I was actually just giving a talk to some students about that, the YA and the debates about whether adults should read them because they're skewing the market or, you know, if it's infantilizing, it's bad for your brain, which of course I think is nonsense and, you know, all the rest of that. So,
yeah. The only kind of bad reading is not reading. That's my thought.
So. Me too.
Okay. So, and I guess I did want to talk, you know, from your personal history, Patricia MacKillop is not somebody that you've read since you were really young, or had you read some and then got more into as you got older?
So I read The Forgotten Beasts of Eld, which I can highly recommend, when I was, I don't know, like a very young teenager, probably around 13 or 14. And I just stumbled on the cover and I liked the cover and I read it. And it was just, it was so beautiful and so unusual that that book, it just stuck in my brain. So I, that's the only one by her I read, which is weird. I don't know why I didn't go and pick up more by her, because I thought it was so beautiful. But I had other books that I was, you know, obsessed with and following and whatever. And then I was thinking about, I wanted to do a PhD and I was trying to figure out, what am I going to do this PhD on? What do I like enough that I can sit there for 6 years studying it? And I knew I wanted to do fantasy, because that, until my master's degree, I didn't know you were allowed to study fantasy. And so I really wanted to do a fantasy for my PhD, because I was like, this is the thing that I've been reading since I was two. Like, this is the thing that I'm really invested in. Yeah, I could do a PhD on kind of mimetic literature, like the literature of the real, but I wouldn't be as invested in it. So I was kind of looking around for an idea, and I started looking at the lists of like World Fantasy Award winners to see if anything sparked something. And I stumbled on her name and the fact that it was the first one. And I thought, oh, well, but there must be a ton of stuff written about her. So, so I went to look, and actually there wasn't. So although I'd only read The Forgotten Beasts of Eld, then when I started, when I decided I was going to do the PhD on her, then I went and read everything. Right. And then over the course of that, of course, I read everything many, many times. And then by the time I got the book out, I had read, you know, that particular subset of text many, 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 many times. And the fact that I can still read them if I want to is amazing, because most of the time that much reading of something is just going to kill it dead. But I, I still enjoy them. So it's great.
Yeah, that's awesome. Okay, so let's go ahead and move into kind of MacKillop 101. If somebody was coming to MacKillop, like me, for instance, and you wanted to say, maybe start here, where would you have them start?
You know, that's so tricky. And I like to have people ask for like personalized recommendations of MacKillop, because she has so many different wonderful ones that I feel like I feel like a responsibility to recommend the right one so that they like her, because she is so wonderful.
That is the right way to think about it though, right? Because nobody ever reads the same book, and you're bringing your view of, you know, what you like to everything.
Right. So. Right. So I say The Forgotten Beasts of Eld. If you like classic fantasy, you're just, or if you just like really ornate, beautiful language, The Forgotten Beasts of Eld is just, I mean, it's just beautifully written and in a style that's pretty unusual. And the fact that she's able to carry that style throughout the whole book is very, very unusual. So I really like The Forgotten Beasts of Eld, and I can recommend that. And it's not that long, you know, it's not going to take up your life reading it. It's pretty short. If you like fairy tales or kind of in our world retellings of things, then Winter Rose is one that I can recommend. One of the people who had worked on Patricia MacKillop, Christine Maines, that's her favorite book, is Winter Rose. It is not my favorite, but that's one of the great things about MacKillop, is there are this, you know, there are these range of books and types and things happening. If you really like Tolkien fantasy, her Tolkien-esque-ist series, the Riddlemaster trilogy, is fun. She wrote it particularly because she was annoyed that Tolkien didn't have any women doing anything particularly important or active. And so she wanted to write something with women as important characters. And particularly the middle and the last book in that trilogy are focused on Radil.
Yeah, in the first book, there's not that much, right? Because the POV character is a man.
Right. And she kind of did that on purpose, because you're kind of put into this kind of traditional fantasy story, and then things start going wrong.
Yes.
And then you have kind of the end surprise, which is very much MacKillop, because she really liked to use and then discard fantasy tropes and often surprise her readers from those. So those are kind of three that you could start with. Ombre and Shadow is also, if you like more detailed kind of plotting, a little bit more intricate, Ombre and Shadow is great. But I mean, so many of them are just excellent that whatever you find in your library is likely to be, you know, good. She does have those science fiction ones which pop up in libraries occasionally. Like Moonflash is one of them. And they're fun, but they're not, it was just clearly not her thing. Mm-hmm.
Well, I can definitely give a hearty recommendation to The Forgotten Beasts of Eld. And when you recommended it to me originally, you know, I mentioned, I'm not a huge fantasy fan. You know, world building is kind of what we were talking about before, right? And you said, well, maybe not The Forgotten Beasts of Eld if you, you know, descriptions of trees and landscapes is going to bother you. I didn't find that there was really, I mean, not that there wasn't any of that. It just never distracted me from the novel. So just a quick little capsule of The Forgotten Beasts of Eld. What is this book about?
So The Forgotten Beasts of Eld starts with a wizard, or rather a family of wizards, whose last wizardling is Sybil, who is a woman, which surprises them a little bit, but they get over it. And so she comes from this long line of these kind of very cold wizard characters who live up in a mountain and kind of collect these ancient beasts. And she inherits many beasts, but she also kind of collects some on her own and is kind of self-contained on this mountain until one day this young man knocks on her door and shoves a baby into her arms and says, "This is your kin and they're trying to kill him. You raise him." And she's kind of like, what do you mean? I don't have kin. I don't know what you're talking about. And so instead of dropping him off a mountain, she does in fact raise the young man. But that causes kind of complications because suddenly she's being drawn into the world of men where there's fighting and, you know, familial ties mean something and there's, wizardry afoot. And she eventually is kind of drawn into this against her will. There's a bit of a love story with her and Corin, who's the young man who dropped off the baby. And eventually it kind of follows their relationship as well as her kind of continuing to hold on to and collect these mythical beasts.
Yeah. And she raises Tam and is essentially asked at some point, you need to pick a side between the kingdom of Cyril and the kingdom of Eld. And she says, well, I'm on Tam's side. I won't do anything to harm him. Even though she's told these very terrible stories about what this king of Eld has done. And so couldn't we move him out of the way and have Tam be the king and then everything would be great? And she's pretty reluctant to use her power to help with that until.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Until.
Yes.
.. Yeah. I mean, I think that's one of the interesting things about the text is the kind of moral complexities of it and the fact that Sybil does try and stay clear of the different sides and then she finds that actually she can't.
Yeah.
And that's troublesome to her.
Yeah.
It's harder to be neutral.
It is. And she's a complicated character too because she's not evil, but she doesn't do everything right. And at some point she starts to realize that doing what I'm doing is wrong. When she kind of draws up her plans because she's angry for a good reason.
She's definitely angry for a good reason. Yeah.
Yeah. But in order to kind of execute on those plans, she has to deceive Corin, right? And
yeah. Yeah. And she kind of has to think about which thing is more important to me, him or, you know, my own personal revenge or my own personal vendetta.
Yeah.
Or-
because she had essentially, Corin had given up his revenge on this other king. And she maybe could have just said, I've decided we don't need to be, we don't need to go back on your original vow to go kill this guy.
Yeah. Yeah, she could have just kind of released him onto it, but that's not really presented as an option within her worldview. And you do get her perspective on things, of course.
Yeah.
So that does change it.
Yes, and she's pretty hard on herself too after all of that. And I really enjoy the relationship between her and Corin and the complexities of loving someone and forgiving them and still being angry.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, how family gets involved with things and then what that actually means if you don't have family or you didn't think you had any family and then, you know, finding connections and using them. And she has been able to live in a way that was kind of aesthetic, like it was separated from any need to think about right or wrong.
Yeah.
She was just doing her academic thing up on the mountain, being a sorceress a wizard as MacKillop calls her. And then, you know, she has to complicate that. And then she starts finding out more about herself and how she deals with anything, the world.
Yeah. But the beasts are wonderful as well. When you look at the Forgotten Beasts of Eld, right, you have this amazing, is it a raven? I can't remember what the bird is. There's more than one bird. There's a swan as well.
There is a swan. Mm-hmm. There is also a raven.
Okay. Yep. And that's it begins with a T, and I can't remember the name.
Now that's just gone straight out of my head, and I can't remember.
Let me see if I can look it up.
Well, I wanted to comment on, you know, one thing you said. You were kind of struggling with the word about how she is dealing with the animals that she has, because they are under her control, mm-hmm. but it's not like in an evil way.
Yeah.
And of course, that's one of the central themes, because Dredd has his own way of controlling things, yes. right? And there's like other characters who control things. And then she herself has to decide how much control is not bad right. and all of that, which makes it, you know, an interesting text.
Yeah. And once the other wizard attempts to call her, right, and exert that control on her and crush her will, she starts to realize that the control that she has over these beasts may not be, you know, a good thing.
Oh, and the falcon is Terror, T-E-R.
That's right. That's right.
Or yes. Terror.
Yeah. The names are wonderful, actually. Like Tamlorn is such a fun name for a character. And the way she calls him My Tam, you know, she's described by Corin as being icy, right? As having a heart of ice. And yet she comes to really love Tam. And the way she calls him My Tam, it was just very sweet.
It is. It's a beautifully written book talking about, you know, relationships and how we become attached to things and then mm-hmm. what that does to us and all the rest of those kinds of things. So yeah, it's
And there's a little bit of snark from the beasts, because they can communicate with her. And you know, at some point the dragon says, there's a cave in the mountains where no one will ever find this guy.
Yeah. The animals, you know, they're intelligent. They are, many of them have lived for centuries and have these really interesting backstories that, like, mm-hmm. she doesn't really go into, but they are there. You know, yeah. you can kind of sense that background.
Yeah.
And like Siren the Boar is a kind of, He'll give her these kind of sarcastic,
he's
like back chat riddles. Yeah.
Yeah.
yeah. and, you know, riddles to things she doesn't want the answer to and that sort of thing. And so, yeah, the creatures themselves are very interesting and part of what's so fun about the text, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. And the Blamor was a really interesting thing. And I don't want to spoil too much about that, but very cool.
Yeah, and you know, it's interesting because the critic Gary Wolf kind of poo-pooed on Blamor, saying that it was just too obvious of a metaphor, et cetera. And I thought, but it's just part of the text. It's just a really nice, I don't know that it's supposed to be a really deep, insightful thing. It's just mm-hmm. it's just something that happens in the text, and it's part of all the other interesting things that happen in the text,
yeah,
you know, that are kind of a surprise that you're not really looking for.
Yeah. Okay, I think we can probably move on. So there were some other titles that you mentioned. You mentioned Ombria and Shadow, and maybe we should just give a quick, what is this book about, you know, to entice people if they want to read, because that's another World Fantasy Award winner, so totally counts as my list.
Yeah, it is. It's really quite an interesting book, and in part, it's really interesting because it's about, like, technically, it's about this little boy whose father has just died. His father was the king, and so now he is the prince, but he's like 7 years old, and there's all of these intrigues. His great-great-great-great-great-great-great-aunt wants the, you know, is the real power and wants the throne, and he's kind of in danger because he doesn't have anybody to protect him, and he's a very little boy. Yeah. But what's interesting is you're not actually following the little boy as like the center of the story. What you're following is the bastard Dukan Greve and then the ex-mistress Lydia. And you follow them through the story as they try to protect the little boy. And they try to make sure that Ombria is still around for him to rule and that he's not himself, you know, assassinated
right.
or just, you know, drugged to the point of mindlessness, et cetera. And so there are complicated pasts and their own complicated connections with the throne and the fact that they're very much people that you don't usually see as the center of fantasy stories, not traditionally anyway. Mm. That makes it a very kind of complex and interesting story. And then it's also very interesting from a magic perspective, because the sort of magic happening in the text is quite unusual. The main sorceress lives underground, might or might not be there. People don't really know that she's underneath the city. She's immensely powerful, but also very lazy.
Right.
So she doesn't really do anything most of the time.
She does work for hire as well.
She does work for hire, and she will, you know, assassinate people if she feels like it. And she will, she's not a good sorcerer precisely. She's kind of amoral because she doesn't really care. Like, she's not human.
Yeah.
How she's not human is not explained, but she isn't quite human.
Yeah.
But that's one of the things that makes Ombre and Shadow so interesting, is that the magical, the way that magic is used and talked about in the book is not your usual splashy or rule-bound kind of explicit magic that you see in most fantasy stories. It's kind of low level until it isn't, and then it really isn't.
Yeah. I mean, there's some stuff like potions, right? Like they make a enchanted piece of charcoal because Dukan sketches wherever he goes. It's kind of his therapy.
Because
that's one of the fascinating things in here, is that I can't remember the regent's name. They all call her the Black Pearl.
I just said her name and now I've forgotten it.
Oh, okay. The Black Pearl will suffice.
Damina Pearl. Damina Pearl is her name.
She essentially has Dukan under threat. You know, don't work against me, or, you know, the prince dies.
And
she's, I won't call her a complicated character. She's not as bloodthirsty as she might be, right? She could have just killed the prince and said, I'm the queen now. But that didn't suit her purposes.
Right. That's one of the things I talk about in my book, is that MacKillop, a lot of the times, her characters are not as straightforward good or evil as we're used to seeing.
Yeah.
And even Damina Pearl, who really in the over of her work is one of the more on the side of evil characters, is actually not as evil as she could be. Mm-hmm. Because she could just straight up murder a lot of people and she doesn't.
Right.
She just, like, she, you know, one of the first things in the novel is that she's just kicking the mistress out the, you know, out the castle door and saying, you know, go away.
Expecting, fully expecting her to be killed in the streets.
She is, but she hasn't actively done it herself. She's just kind of sent her off to die because she knows that, you know, she's not a very liked character, obviously, because of her position. She's also wearing a lot of jewelry, you know, and is going out into this really poor part of the city, etc. So Damina Pearl is pretty, she's pretty bad, but she's not, certainly not the most evil character, even in the general direction of the most evil character in fantasy literature.
Yeah. This is one I think I would like to reread, just because some of the shadow kingdom, the underground kind of stuff, I think went a little over my head. And it could have been just a function of doing this one on audio, and I don't take it in quite the same way. But it reminded me a little bit, I don't know if you've read The City in the City.
Yes, I have.
Where there were like two halves of the city, and it's like, do they acknowledge that the other, everybody kind of knows that the shadow area exists, but
I think MacKillop's is in some ways it's a little bit subtler, because it has kind of a different message than The City in the City. Like, The City in the City, I think, is a little bit more political about, like, who do you see and who do you choose to ignore? Mm-hmm. Whereas in Ombria, there are people who genuinely don't seem to know about the shadow city, and then also some people who think it's there, but it's not interacting with them. And then there's other people who can see it, but they don't know that they're seeing it.
Yeah, it's the deep state.
Like, there's these like multiple levels. And the shadow city, I think it's intended to be really ambiguous, which is probably why you didn't pick it up on the first, or as much on the first reading. I think that's pretty normal with Ombre and Shadow, because it's quite, that's one of the reasons I call it complex, because it's got this other thing happening, but it's subtler than The City in the City, I think.
Yeah, because there were various times where I'm like, is the Shadow City, is it the underworld? Is it like Hades? Or is it just a part of the city that isn't well lit, you know, that doesn't have good infrastructure?
Or is it, you know, like a magic shadow of the actual city that it's like kind of there, but it's not? And, you know, can you get to it through a mirror? Maybe.
Right. Is
maybe
it the upside not, down, you know, from Stranger Things?
How does this work? And I think that's part of the, you know, what makes it an interesting novel is the confusion.
And this was another one I really enjoyed. And like I said, you know, if I want to reread a book, that's usually a good sign. I think we can move on from that one. But that, okay. I think that's an excellent one to recommend as a kind of starter novel. I can't remember what else you mentioned. I think you did mention the Riddlemaster series as you like a more Tolkien kind of thing.
Yeah, that's her most overtly Tolkien-esque text. And like I said, that was on purpose. You know, she was kind of annoyed with the Lord of the Rings. She loved them, but she also was annoyed with them. Mm-hmm. And you know, you have to remember that she was writing from the, you know, late 60s. So even though she was writing up until 2015, that's a long time ago. And the fantasy landscape was very different then. It was a lot of like Tolkien and Lewis and C.S. Williams. And, you know, you weren't seeing, there was like Le Guin.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And maybe Andre Norton, or, you know, other women under pseudonyms, et cetera. So, she wanted to kind of emphasize that. And so that it's Tolkien-esque and it's the most Tolkien-esque of her books. It is a trilogy, you know, it's quite long. It's quite complex in terms of the, you know, it's moving across this whole world. There's the battle between like good forces and evil forces, which she didn't do as much later on. It tended to be more ambiguous than that. Mm. So in some ways, it's less subtle than many of her later books, but it's a fun read. And particularly if you like that kind of really epic fantasy where it's moving across big portions of land and there's lots of things happening and there's these like different cultures that you're running into and all that sort of stuff, then it's fun. It's a fun trilogy.
I will say, so I only picked up, Audible had a huge sale where I almost everything that McKillop wrote was like $3 or less. And so I picked up several of them and I did pick up the first of the Riddlemaster series. And it's funny that you say the most Tolkien-esque, and I've been critical of Tolkien on my podcast in the past where I am reading The Hobbit right now for another podcast, not for my podcast, just to follow along with somebody else's and just trying to enjoy it a chapter at a time kind of thing. But I worry about what's going to happen when I get to The Lord of the Rings because I struggled with that. And I struggled a little with The Riddlemaster. It was definitely more fun than it was more on the level of like The Hobbit, a little more accessible than The Lord of the Rings. But I could see how it could get more kind of complex and spiral off into epic things that I don't care as much about.
Yeah, it does. So that's, you know, why I say if you're interested in the kind of Tolkien-esque thing, it's not necessarily her best book, capital B. It's not the best written, etc. But it still has lots to recommend it, particularly if you're interested in that kind of epic fantasy. The texts are quite different. Like the first one, you start with the young man and you're kind of following him through his journey and finding out what's going on. And that one also feels quite a bit like Le Guin's Earthsea books to me, although I like it better, I'll admit. And then you have the middle text where Rhaederal, his love, is kind of the main character and you're following her and she's trying to find him and wondering what the heck's going on. And then the third book is they're kind of joining to fight off this kind of great evil in the world and find out about it, etc. But there's a few more surprises, I think. It's a little bit the third book in particular, you are probably not guessing what happens.
Okay.
A degree. Or at least to a part of it. It gets far more complicated in the way that McKillop likes to complicate her books, where good versus evil isn't as clear as it is. And you have these kind of tropes that she's subverting, and she's using the fact that you're used to reading fantasy against you because you're expecting something to happen and then something else happens.
Right, right. So some of that doesn't work on me just because I'm not as well versed in fantasy. You know, I grew up reading the Prydain Chronicles. Those were ones I loved when I was a kid. I still love them. But since then, haven't read a ton of fantasy. And so, like, I saw somebody, I had read A Game of Thrones and I just kind of went, I mean, it was fine. But, and somebody's like, oh no, it's a brilliant dissection of epic fantasy. And I'm like, well, I haven't read enough of that for that to work on me. So, Maybe I'll come back to it and find out that it is that. Who knows?
Yeah. Yeah. Like I said, it's one of her earlier texts and it's not as well written as later ones. I'm not to say that it's badly written or anything. It's just she was still kicking into gear, I think. And then, you know, after that, she's really kind of got moving.
Okay. Cool. I mean, we've kind of covered some of the basics. So do you want to move into stuff that's less well known? You mentioned the science fiction books, but if there's other titles that you think, okay, if you've read a little bit of McKillop, if you've read The Riddlemaster, you've read Forgotten Beasts of Eld, maybe some other titles that folks might like to know about. And actually, I did want to ask this as well. Sorry, I set you up to start talking and then I I'd been wanting to ask, are there any other, not series, but do the worlds ever come together? Are there other books that are set in the same universe as The Forgotten Beasts of Eld or anything like that?
No. And okay. That was one of the really interesting things. And one of the reasons I chose her for my book on world building is that she tends to build these beautiful little jewels and then she just moves on.
Okay.
So she has, you know, the Riddle Masters, a trilogy. She has a duology of the Signet books. And that's about it. Everything else is fairly clearly independent. Wow. And now that she's passed away, I can say for sure that none of them ever connect. So there is Solstice Wood, which is kind of a follow-up to Winter Rose. It's like kind of ish in the same-ish world. Okay. But other than that, they're basically just independent texts, which is really fairly unusual. You know, she had some of these were very successful. Umbrian Shadow is award-winning, Forgotten Beasts of Eld award-winning. You would think that she would return to that world and continue, but she didn't. She moves on. She has something different.
You'd think a literary agent would be like, we need another book in this series.
Yes.
And then you could get into the series death spiral that happens.
Right. Exactly. But apparently not. And, you know, her individual books are, they're self-contained. And to me, that's kind of fun, actually, because you really feel like, okay, I'm finished with this text, with this world. Yeah. And then you can move on.
Well, and too, that means there's not homework. If you just want to pick up a title, you're probably safe.
Yes. Yeah, definitely. And even if you started like in the middle of the Riddle Master trilogy or on the second one of the Signet duology, even then you're okay. You're not going to be completely floundering.
Okay. All right. So advanced titles, any other places you'd have people go if they've kind of gotten their, dip their toes in, for instance.
Yeah. there are so many, like I can't not recommend any of her books. Even right back to one of the very first ones that she wrote, which was in some ways the most simplistic, The Throne of the Errol of Sherrill, is really fun. It's super short, really, really short, and really kind of typical in some ways, typical fantasy, and yet it just bops along, and then it has this really interesting world that's like constructed in, you know, three pages, and then it has the kind of surprise ending like everything else she does. So it's like everything she did in miniature. And it's kind of this, you know, you've got these silly names and they're all related to like their jobs, like the damson is the damsel in distress and things like that. So it's kind of like obvious, but it's also fun. Then you have texts like The Song of the Basilisk, which I love. If people have read MacKillop, they probably will have read it, but it's not necessarily the first one that they would head to. But it's just, it's an interesting book with an interesting main character who's kind of going on this quest for knowledge first and then revenge once he realizes who he is and what's happened in his life.
I read that one over this last week and really enjoyed it. It had a great hook to it, starting with the child in the ashes. You're like, ooh, what is going on here? And then, you know, off to train with the bards and that kind of stuff. And that one, as the title might suggest, features a lot of discussions of music and opera, and there was a hilarious description of Damiette, Lady Damiette's voice was described as energetic, untuned, and oblivious of art. Yes. and I'm somebody who was I studied engineering in college, but I was in the concert choir and the chamber singers and things like that, and I was around music people all the time. And there are people who want to major in music and maybe are a brilliant, you know, pianist or something, and they have to also do vocal recitals. And sometimes,
that is,
you know,
not good.
God bless them, but but nope, that's not your gifting. And I know you're enthusiastic about it, but let's stick with the piano.
And that's one of the things I really like about MacKillop is they're full of moments of humor like that. But you know, they're not funny books. They're not like Connie Willis or something that's really going for the for the laugh. But there are moments of humor, and there's also these kind of gentle relationships in them that are not, you know, it's not explicit, it's not a big deal, but they're just kind of there throughout the text. And I think that's also quite unusual in our day and age to see things kind of handled in that way. So those are both things that I enjoy. And Song for the Basilisk does both of those really, you know, beautifully.
Yeah, I thought it was great.
Yeah, so that one's fun. I mean, honestly, I could recommend literally anything that you find of hers. Okay. Even those kind of weird science fiction. Moonflash is one of them. They're not as good as her fantasy, but they're not bad. You know, they're
What category of science fiction would she fall into? Is she doing hard science fiction, space opera?
They're space opera, kind of. Okay. I think. Yeah, they're kind of confused themselves, but I would say space opera.
I mean, I don't mind like genre straddling. That's always kind of interesting, where you're like, is this fantasy or is this science fiction?
It is, but I think it's more because she's such a fantasy writer that she couldn't let that, like, that aspect of herself she couldn't separate it out from what she was writing. Nice. Not to say that it's bad. It's just, you know, she clearly had a genre that was really where she shone, and that's okay. And I personally prefer her texts where it's like all in a secondary world. So the Signet duology that I was talking about, those are really also really interesting new worlds in each one. You follow a different main character in each one, but it's kind of in, say, the same sections of the world, and you meet some of the same characters.
Okay.
And there's a lot of kind of mythic stuff and also fantasy tropes that she either follows or steps on.
Hey, for somebody like me who's not as familiar with fantasy, that term secondary world, I remember coming across that in your book. And can you describe what that is, and what's the distinction between, you know, the types of fantasy that are secondary world and primary world?
Yes. So not to go too academic.
Okay.
Because those
she adjusts her glasses.
Those are very fraught definitions and lines. But basically, primary world is like our world, you know, okay. Our recognizable world. We're here. So, you know, C.S. Lewis, the first part of his books are definitely in the primary world.
Right. Right? Yeah, the Percy Jackson series is in our
world. Percy Jackson, yeah. And then secondary world means you are on a different world than ours. So it's clearly not us. And most of her texts are clearly not in our world. They're on some other world entirely.
Okay.
And there's a lot of shades in between that and people who argue about what it means, but that's like the basics for it. And she does have books that are like Winter Rose and Solstice Wood are two that are kind of in our world, it seems, New England-esque worlds. And then she had Kingfisher, which is her very last book, which was also kind of in parts of maybe the Northern United States or Canada. And so there's magical things happening, but they're like kind of in our world.
Okay.
And a lot of people really like those. And they are explicitly linked to kind of fairy tales. Kingfisher, obviously the myth of the Kingfisher. Mm-hmm. And then Winter Rose is a retelling of Tamlin, which is a kind of lesser known fairy tale, or folktale rather. So those, you know, if you like that kind of thing, then you like those. And a lot of people do. They're just not my favorites. Just because I think, to me, the world building and how she creates these fantasy worlds that are completely separate from us and yet feel very real, to me, that's one of her strengths.
Hmm.
So I prefer her books that are like completely set on different worlds.
Yeah. Let's see. You said you could pretty much recommend anything.
You know, and then I'm sitting here thinking, and I'm like, wait, I have to mention The Tower at Stony Woods too, because that one's awesome as well. And it is. It's a really interesting look at, again, it's playing with those expectations and with fairy tale and how they're meant to go. I don't think you have to be super familiar with fantasy, though, to follow along and to enjoy the text. It's just that there's a lot of things that you're set up for that you then get smacked on the head because they're not the way that you're expecting them to be. One small instance is that there's like a part of it is the Lady of Shalott story where, you know, the lady's in the tower and she just kind of sits there silently and people try and rescue her, etc. And that's kind of subverted, although I won't say how.
Okay, fun.
And then Alphabet of Thorn is also one of the ones that tends to not get read as much, but I like assigning it to students actually because it's one of the YAE ones, and it's about this character kind of coming to realize her own heritage, etc., and then kind of dealing with what that means. She thinks she's an orphan. She thinks that she's been brought up by these librarians, and she's going to be a librarian, and everything's fine. And then she finds out that actually she's like the child of a very powerful, world-conquering sorceress and king, and she has to kind of make decisions about what that's going to mean for her life and for the life of like literally everybody around her. So that one's also, it's less subtle than other of her texts, but it's fun.
Nice. Perfect. I guess, are there, have you seen that there's other authors that are influenced, clearly influenced by Mikalip? Or are there other authors that you think write similarly? I know that you've focused a lot on Mikalip, and so if you don't know, then that's fine.
Yeah, I have. And, you know, part of the problem with being an academic who studies this stuff is that actually you start getting really far behind. So I'm just not as up to date as I would like to be with all of the recent stuff. I don't know offhand. I know a lot of authors who have said that she influenced them, but I don't necessarily see her writing in their works, if that makes sense. So she did influence a lot of writers. And I have seen, you know, a lot of blurbs and things from writers, but I haven't necessarily seen her in other writers, which I think is a testament to how well she does what she did. And how kind of unique it was to take these individual worlds and have this whole story happen and then to move on to another one and another one and another one. And so basically, I mean, there's probably people who are going to listen to this podcast and be like, oh, how do you not know X who's clearly influenced by Patricia Mikalip? Or like, why don't you know that X person has definitely said that they are, you know, but I personally have not run into, and I've read obviously a lot of fantasy, a lot of fantasy, and I haven't found anything that strikes me as exactly like hers.
Okay. I mean, uniqueness is nice. And, you know, especially in today's media landscape where, you know, you look over the top 20 films in any given year and 18 of them are from existing series, existing IP. And, you know, you get two original things that happen to work. And
definitely.
I'd like to see more standalone products. Nothing in adaptation, though, for Mikalip at this point.
No.
Is that right?
No, I don't know if it's simply because she's just not that well known outside of really kind of fantasy circles, or if it's because they think that doing her books would be difficult, which they probably would be.
Sure.
They would involve a lot of, I don't know, to be honest, I think they're too subtle. I think it would be, you know, they would be one of those movies that is hard to film because so much is happening in the characters' brains.
Yeah.
And that would be hard to, it's possible to convey that in movies, and I've seen it done successfully, but it's rare.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I think maybe a combination of those.
Yeah, I feel like it. You know, this Forgotten Beasts of Eld with the snarky pig Cyril would be a good person to bounce thoughts off of, right? And because he actually speaks, where the other beasts just speak mind to mind with
Cyril. And you could make them like the dragon. You could make him speak.
Yeah, absolutely.
But even then, you know, the Brumulb and all of that kind of, like how he does his thing. It's possible. I mean, it's possible. I could see a movie of the Forgotten Beasts of Eld, but I don't think we'll get one. Which
you could very easily get a rated R movie of that because it's quite grim in places, but not in your face, right? Not explicitly. So
yeah, it's grim, but not explicit. And I like that about Mikalip because not that I dislike books that are explicit. I don't have a problem with them, but it's interesting the way that she covers these really quite dark topics or these really quite dark themes without actually showing you much.
Yeah. Yeah.
She's talking about kind of the emotional side of things more than like physically what is happening.
Yeah. Because I feel like, you know, you could do Forgotten Beasts of Eld as a read aloud for a, you know, a grade school kid. And in your mind, it might be grimmer than in theirs. And you could lighten it up a little bit. have some interesting discussions about consent, for instance, in a couple spots in that book.
Yeah. And of course, you know, consent, which is such a popular or clear topic nowadays. I mean, she wrote this in 1970. And she's talking about consent in this in this world, and not just, you know, one kind of consent, but lots of different kinds of consent. Mm-hmm. And so I think she was really ahead of her time in many ways.
Excellent. I think that's about the end of my notes. I don't know if you have anything else that you wanted to talk about.
Nothing's coming to mind.
Okay. Well, then do you have any online presence that you want to talk about?
I have my website, but it's a super basic website. But if people are interested in the academic work that I've done on her, then there's links to like the papers that are freely available online and that sort of thing. I am on Twitter, X. Sorry,
right. But I'm never going to call it X.
Yeah, but I've basically disassociated from that, et cetera. So I am around. My website has a contact form, and I'm happy to answer questions or make a personalized recommendation or anything.
I was going to say, I got a nice email with personalized recommendations for books to read.
Yeah.
I don't want to promise that you can do that for everyone.
No, but I'm happy, and I love talking about her, and I talk to groups all the time about, I do non-academic talks as well as academic talks. And so I'm always happy to do that kind of thing too. So yeah, I just I like talking about her. I feel a little bit like a MacKillop evangelist.
Yes. Yeah.
Which is funny, academics are not supposed to show that they're like super into the books that they're reading, but she's just wonderful, and her books deserve to be read by so many more people than they are. I think that would just be lovely to have that as a
legacy. For the authors that I'm more familiar with, right? I hope that the episodes that we do on those authors have the effect that this one did for me, just introducing me to a delightful author and wonderful books. And I really hope that that works for my listeners. And I know that, some of my patrons were like, I've never heard of this author. I'd like to have this episode. And so that's why we're here.
Yeah, I certainly hope that it works. And people shouldn't be too scared of the book, because I did write it, or my publishers in particular were very interested in having it spread to the kind of creative writing side of things for people to be, which is why it got the title that it did, because of course you don't get to
choose. Art of fantasy world building.
Yeah. So, give it a knock if you're at all interested in that sort of thing, and definitely try MacKillop, because I think she's just wonderful.
Yeah. Well, I want to thank you very much for reaching out and introducing me to this wonderful author.
Well, thank you so much for having me. And I'm really glad of the chance to kind of spread the word on MacKillop. And I do hope that more people like you will find that something to love.
I hope so too. Audrey, this has been wonderful. It's a really great conversation. And really appreciate it.
Well, thank you so much for having me. Really enjoyed it.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, folks, I hope you enjoyed that discussion with Audrey. I thought it was fantastic, and I highly recommend that you check out works by Patricia MacKillop. I'll have a whole list of everything that we talked about in this episode. And if you're a fan of Patricia MacKillop or fantasy, or want to learn more about fantasy world building, pick up Audrey's book, Patricia A. MacKillop and the Art of Fantasy World Building. And you can find information on that on Audrey's website, which I'll also provide. So this is this kind of episode. I hope that these episodes have the effect on my listeners that this one did on me, just introducing me to a new author that I really enjoy now. And let me know, is that the effect that this kind of thing has on you? I'd love to hear that. This is actually the first time that I'm recording since the Hugo Awards were announced, because I've been running a backlog. And so I'm finally catching back up. And so I want to send a hearty congratulations to Hugo Girl. To Amy, Lori, Haley, and Kevin, congratulations. Well-earned. Super thrilled about that. That's awesome. We also recently got the Hugo voting data, and that showed that this podcast placed second, and that's very exciting. So thank you so much to everybody who voted for this podcast. I appreciate it. I'd love to have your support next year as well. Since I am planning on attending Worldcon, I hope to see many of you there as well. So as usual, if you enjoyed this podcast, feel free to share it on any social media platform, leave reviews, all that kind of stuff. If you want to provide some financial support to this podcast, you can do that in a couple of different ways. There is patreon.com/hugospodcast, where you can go and sign up to support there. The main thing that you get there is you get the episodes a little bit earlier, and you do get to participate in things like polls. I put up a poll about which author we should do a deep dive on next, and Patricia MacKillop won that. So that's why we got this episode this quickly. Though it wasn't quickly. I do have some other ideas that I want to float to the folks on Patreon about other things that I can do to make it worth supporting the podcast other than just supporting the podcast because you like it. I'd like to give something back as well. But also, if you don't want to do a monthly kind of thing, you can go to buymeacoffee.com/SethHeasleD. Just Seth Heasley, but chop off the Y and add a D. Link is in the show notes. So if you want to do that, that'd be great. Somebody just recently bought me a coffee, and I appreciate it. Okay, I will talk to you next time. Bye-bye.
The theme music for the Hugo's There podcast was composed and performed by Tim Kuske.